Chapter 56. This man stepped before them as they turned round, and pulling his hat off, and keeping it off, ducked his head to Mr. Dombey. "Beg your pardon, sir," apostrophe said the man, "but I hope you're a doing pretty well, sir." Apostrophe, he was dressed in a canvas suit abundantly besmeared with coal dust and oil, and had cinders in his whiskers, and a smell of half-slaked ashes all over him. He was not a bad-looking fellow, nor even what could be fairly called a dirty-looking fellow, in spite of this, and, in short, he was Mr. Tootle, professionally clothed. "I shall have the honor of stoking of you down, sir," apostrophe said Mr. Tootle. "Beg your pardon, sir. I hope you find yourself a coming round?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Dombey looked at him, in return for his tone of interest, as if a man like that would make his very eyesight dirty. "Excuse the liberty, sir," apostrophe said Tootle, seeing he was not clearly remembered, "but my wife Polly, as was called Richards in your family," apostrophe, a change in Mr. Dombey's face, which seemed to express recollection of him, and so it did, but it expressed in a much stronger degree an angry sense of humiliation, stopped Mr. Tootle short. "Your wife wants money, I suppose," apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, putting his hand in his pocket, and speaking, but that he always did, haughtily. "No thank ye, sir," apostrophe returned Tootle, "I can't say she does. I don't." Apostrophe, Mr. Dombey was stopped short now in his turn, and awkwardly, with his hand in his pocket. "No, sir," apostrophe said Tootle, turning his oilskin cap round and round, "we're a doing pretty well, sir. We haven't no cause to complain in the worldly way, sir. We've had four more since then, sir, but we're ups on." Apostrophe, Mr. Dombey would have rubbed onto his own carriage, though in so doing he had rubbed the stoker underneath the wheels, but his attention was arrested by something in connection with the cap still going slowly round and round in the man's hand. "We lost one babby," apostrophe observed Tootle, "there's no denying." Apostrophe, lately, apostrophe added Mr. Dombey, looking at the cap. "No, sir, a part of 3 years ago, but all the rest is hearty. And in the matter o' riding, sir," apostrophe said Tootle, ducking again, as if to remind Mr. Dombey of what had passed between them on that subject long ago, "them boys o' mine, they learned me, among 'em, arter all. They've made a worry tolerable scholar of me, sir, them boys." Apostrophe, "come, major." Apostrophe, apostrophe said Mr. Dombey. "Beg your pardon, sir," apostrophe resumed Tootle, taking a step before them, and deferentially stopping them again, still cap in hand. "I wouldn't have troubled you with such a pint except as a way of getting in the name of my son Byler christened Robin him as he was so good, as to make a charitable grinder on." Apostrophe, "well, man," apostrophe said Mr. Dombey in his severest manner. "What about him?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "why, sir," apostrophe returned Tootle, shaking his head with a face of great anxiety and distress, "I'm forced to say, sir, that he's gone wrong." "He has gone wrong, has he?" Apostrophe, apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, with a hard kind of satisfaction. "He has fell into bad company, you see, gentlemen," apostrophe pursued the father, looking wistfully at both, and evidently taking the major into the conversation with the hope of having his sympathy. "He has got into bad ways. God send he may come to again, gentlemen, but he's on the wrong track now. You could hardly be off hearing of it somehow, sir," apostrophe said Tootle, again addressing Mr. Dombey individually, "and it's better I should out and say my boy's gone rather wrong. Polly's dreadful down about it, gentlemen," apostrophe said Tootle with the same dejected look, and another appeal to the major. "A son of this man's whom I caused to be educated, major," apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, giving him his arm. "The usual return. Apostrophe, take advice from plain old Joe, and never educate that sort of people, sir," apostrophe returned the major. "Damn, sir, it never does. It always fails. ... The simple father was beginning to submit, that he hoped his son, the quantum grinder, huffed and cuffed, and flogged and badged, and taught, as parrots are, by a brute jobbed into his place of schoolmaster with as much fitness for it as a hound, might not have been educated on quite a right plan in some undiscovered respect, when Mr. Dombey angrily repeating the usual return, ... let the major away, and the major being heavy to hoist into Mr. Dombey's carriage, elevated in mid-air, and having to stop and swear that he would flay the native alive, and break every bone in his skin, and visit other physical torments upon him, every time he couldn't get his foot on the step, and fell back on that dark exile, had barely time, before they started to repeat hoarsely, that it would never do, that it always failed, and that if he were to educate his own vagabond, ... he would certainly be hanged. Mr. Dombey assented bitterly, but there was something more in his bitterness, and in his moody way of falling back in the carriage, and looking with knitted brows at the changing objects without, than the failure of that noble educational system administered by the Grinders Company. He had seen upon the man's rough cap a piece of new crepe, and he had assured himself, from his manner and his answers, that he wore it for his son. So, from high to low, at home or abroad, from Florence in his great house to the coarse churl who was feeding the fire then smoking before them, everyone set up some claim or other to a share in his dead boy, and was a bitter against him. Could he ever forget how that woman had wept over his pillow, and called him her own child, or how he, waking from his sleep, had asked for her, and had raised himself in his bed, and brightened when she came in? To think of this presumptuous raker among coals and ashes going on before there, with his sign of mourning! To think that he dared to enter, even by a common show like that, into the trial and disappointment of a proud gentleman's secret heart. To think that this lost child, who was to have divided with him his riches, and his projects, and his power, and allied with whom he was to have shut out all the world, as with a double door of gold, should have let in such a herd, to insult him with their knowledge of his defeated hopes, and their boasts of claiming community of feeling with himself, so far removed, if not of having crept into the place wherein he would have lorded it, alone. He found no pleasure or relief in the journey. Tortured by these thoughts, he carried monotony with him, through the rushing landscape, and hurried headlong, not through a rich and varied country, but a wilderness of blighted plans and gnawing jealousies. The very speed at which the train was whirled along, mocked the swift course of the young life, that had been borne away so steadily and so inexorably to its foredoomed end. The power that forced itself upon its iron way its own defiant of all paths and roads, piercing through the heart of every obstacle, and dragging living creatures of all classes, ages, and degrees behind it, was a type of the triumphant monster, death. Away, with a shriek, and a roar, and a rattle, from the town, burrowing among the dwellings of men and making the streets hum, flashing out into the meadows for a moment, mining in through the damp earth, booming on in darkness and heavy air, bursting out again into the sunny day so bright and wide. Away, with a shriek, and a roar, and a rattle, through the fields, through the woods, through the corn, through the hay, through the chalk, through the mold, through the clay, through the rock, among objects close at hand and almost in the grasp, ever flying from the traveler, and a deceitful distance ever moving slowly within him. Like as in the track of the remorseless monster, death. Through the hollow, on the height, by the heath, by the orchard, by the park, by the garden, over the canal, across the river, where the sheep are feeding, where the mill is going, where the barge is floating, where the dead are lying, where the factory is smoking, where the stream is running, where the village clusters, where the great cathedral rises, where the bleak moor lies, and the wild breeze smooths, or ruffles it at its inconstant will. Away, with a shriek, and a roar, and a rattle, and no trace to leave behind, but dust and vapor. Like as in the track of the remorseless monster, death. breasting the wind and light, the shower and sunshine, away, and still away, it rolls and roars, fierce and rapid, smooth, and certain, and great works and massive bridges crossing up above, fall like a beam of shadow an inch broad, upon the eye, and then are lost. Away, and still away, onward, and onward ever. Glimpses of cottage homes, of houses, mansions, rich estates, of husbandry and handicraft, of people, of old roads and paths that look deserted, small, and insignificant as they are left behind. And so they do, and what else is there but such glimpses, in the track of the indomitable monster, death? Away, with a shriek, and a roar, and a rattle, plunging down into the earth again, and working on in such a storm of energy and perseverance, that amidst the darkness and whirlwind the motion seems reversed, and to tend furiously backward, until a ray of light upon the wet wall shows its surface flying past like a fierce stream, away once more into the day, and through the day, with a shrill yell of exultation, roaring, rattling, tearing on, spurning everything with its dark breath, sometimes pausing for a minute, where a crowd of faces are, that in a minute more are not, sometimes lapping water greedily, and before the spout at which it drinks has ceased to drip upon the ground, shrieking, roaring, rattling through the purple distance. Louder and louder yet, it shrieks and cries as it comes tearing on resistless to the goal. And now its way, still like the way of death, is strewn with ashes thickly. Everything around is blackened. There are dark pools of water, muddy lanes, and miserable habitations far below. There are jagged walls and falling houses close at hand, and through the battered roofs and broken windows, wretched rooms are seen, where want and fever hide themselves in many wretched shapes, while smoke and crowded gables, and distorted chimneys, and deformity of brick and mortar penning up deformity of mind and body, choke the murky distance. As Mr. Dombey looks out of his carriage window, it is never in his thoughts that the monster who has brought him there has let the light of day in on these things. Not made or caused them. It was the journey's fitting end, and might have been the end of everything. It was so ruinous and dreary. Apostrophe, so, pursuing the one course of thought, he had the one relentless monster still before him. All things looked black, and cold, and deadly upon him, and beyond him. He found a likeness to his misfortune everywhere. There was a remorseless triumph going on about him, and it galled, and stung him in his pride and jealousy, whatever form it took. Though most of all, when it divided with him the love, and memory of his lost boy. There was a face he had looked upon it, on the previous night, and it on him with eyes, that read his soul, though they were dim with tears, and hidden soon behind two quivering hands that often had attended him in fancy, on this ride. He had seen it, with the expression of last night, timidly pleading to him. It was not reproachful, but there was something of doubt, almost of hopeful incredulity in it, which, as he once more saw, that fade away into a desolate certainty of his dislike, was like reproach. It was a trouble to him to think of this face of Florence. Because he felt any new compunction towards it? No. Because the feeling it awakened in him, of which he had had some old foreshadowing in older times, was full form now, and spoke out plainly, moving him too much, and threatening to grow too strong for his composure. Because the face was a broad, in the expression of defeat and persecution, that seemed to encircle him like the air. Because it barbed the arrow of that cruel and remorseless enemy on which his thoughts so ran, and put into its grasp a double-handed sword. Because he knew full well, in his own breast, as he stood there, tinging the scene of transition before him with the morbid colors of his own mind, and making it a ruin and a picture of decay, instead of hopeful change, and promise of better things, that life had quite as much to do with his complainings as death. One child was gone, and one child left. Why was the object of his hope removed instead of her? The sweet, calm, gentle presence in his fancy moved him to no reflection but that she had been unwelcome to him from the first. She was an aggravation of his bitterness now. If his son had been his only child, and the same blow had fallen on him, it would have been heavy to bear, but infinitely lighter than now, when it might have fallen on her whom he could have lost, or he believed it, without a pang, and had not. Her loving and innocent face rising before him, had no softening or winning influence. He rejected the angel, and took up with the tormenting spirit crouching in his bosom. Her patience, goodness, youth, devotion, love, were as so many atoms in the ashes upon which he set his heel. He saw her image in the blight and blackness all around him, not irradiating but deepening the gloom. More than once upon this journey, and now again as he stood pondering at this journey's end, tracing figures in the dust with his stick, the thought came into his mind, what was there he could interpose between himself and it. The major, who had been blowing and panting all the way down, like another engine, and whose eye had often wandered from his newspaper, to leer at the prospect, as if there were a procession of discomfited Miss Toxes pouring out in the smoke of the train, and flying away over the fields, to hide themselves in any place of refuge, aroused his friends by informing him that the post horses were harnessed, and the carriage ready. "Dommy," apostrophe said the major, rapping him on the arm with his cane, "don't be thoughtful. It's a bad habit. Old Joe, sir, wouldn't be as tough as you see him, if he had ever encouraged it. You are too great a man, Dommy, to be thoughtful. In your position, sir, you're far above that kind of thing." Apostrophe, the major even in his friendly remonstrances, thus consulting the dignity and honor of Mr. Dombey, and showing a lively sense of their importance, Mr. Dombey felt more than ever disposed to defer to a gentleman possessing so much good sense and such a well-regulated mind. Accordingly he made an effort to listen to the major's stories, as they trotted along the turnpike road. And the major, finding both the pace and the road a great deal better adapted to his conversational powers than the mode of traveling they had just relinquished, came out of his entertainment. But still the major, blunt and tough as he was, and as he so very often said he was, administered some palatable catering to his companion's appetite. He related, or rather suffered it to escape him, accidentally, and as one might say, grudgingly and against his will, how there was great curiosity and excitement at the club, in regard of his friend Dombey. How he was suffocated with questions, sir. How old Joe Backstock was a greater man than ever, there, on the strength of Dombey. How they said, "Backstock, your friend Dombey now, what is the view he takes of such and such a question?" "Though, by the rude, sir," apostrophe said the major, with a broad stare, "how they discovered that J.B. ever came to know you, is a mystery." Apostrophe apostrophe, in this flow of spirits and conversation, only interrupted by his usual plethoric symptoms, and by intervals of lunch, and from time to time by some violent assault upon the native, who wore a pair of earrings in his dark brown ears, and on whom his European clothes sat with an outlandish impossibility of adjustment being, of their own accord, and without any reference to the tailor's art, long where they ought to be short, short where they ought to be long, tight where they ought to be loose, and loose where they ought to be tight, and to which he imparted a new grace, whenever the major attacked him, by shrinking into them like a shriveled nut, or a cold monkey in this Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.